Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Cubberley Theater in Palo Alto. My name is Dr. Meredith Rudolph. We would like to extend special thanks tonight to the Bernard Osher Foundation for supporting our program. It is my pleasure to introduce Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Adam was born in Philadelphia and raised in Montreal, Canada, where he earned his Bachelor of Arts degree from McGill University. He then moved to New York and completed his graduate work at the New York University of Fine Arts. Adam has spent the last 25 years writing fiction, humor, book reviews, and art critiques for The New Yorker. In 1995, he moved to Paris with his wife and infant son and wrote the Paris Journal column for the magazine for 5 years. His expanded essay collection, Paris to the Moon, was published in 2000 and quickly became a New York Times bestseller. As well as authoring several books, including 2 novels for children, Adam is a 3-time recipient of the National Magazine Awards for Essay and for Criticism, and the winner of the George Polk Award for Magazine Reporting. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Adam Gopnik.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I wanted to talk a little bit about my new book, but I thought I would do it in a slightly roundabout way by telling you a story about my wife's taste in meat. The theme of this book, of The Table Comes First, I think can sort of be simply summarized. It's about how mouth taste becomes moral taste and moral taste becomes mouth taste. And what do I mean by that? I mean just that any food that we like, any taste that we have, anything that vibrates inside our palate, instantly, it's part of being a human being, part of being a creature that lives with a kind of transitive, transformative mind, instantly becomes a moral taste. If you like the taste of locally grown organic zucchini, you instantly turn that into a moral principle. That's the right way to eat. God thinks very much this way. You know, God tasted a pork chop at some time in the past and then said, this is terrible, I hate it, anyone who eats one is a sinner. Mouth taste constantly is in the habit of becoming moral taste, and our moral taste becomes our mouth taste. And I experience this in my family. I come from a family of long and mostly happy marriages, but within every marriage I know in my family, there's always an argument about mouth taste and moral taste. There's always some kind of argument about food. I think often of my uncle Ron and my aunt Rose, who spent their entire 60-year marriage arguing about whether or not people in restaurants gave you larger portions in order to charge you more, or whether they charged you more because they were giving you larger portions. And this argument went from Philadelphia to Florida and on and beyond, over and over again. Right, it was like a Beckett play. The reason that they're charging you more, Ron, is because they're giving you such large portions. No, the reason they're giving you large portions is because they want to charge you more. It was an unanswerable kind of debate. And my parents have had the same kind of argument for as long as I've known them. They argue about desserts a great deal. My mother's a very good cook, and we'll talk about that a bit tonight, I hope. But she always makes too many desserts and forces my father to eat them. And for 50 years, I've heard him protesting every night unsuccessfully about having to eat an extra dessert. When I got married, which I did rather young, actually, I discovered that my wife, Martha, did one thing that I thought was sort of shocking and sort of intolerable, that violated my moral beliefs about food, and that was that she wanted everything well done. And I grew up in a family where rare was a kind of moral statement in itself. That is, having your food rare all the time was a sign that you were in touch with France, with sophisticated taste, with a really rich view of the natural the natural. If something was bloody and a little bit raw, it showed that the thing itself was good. And Martha, I realized, not only liked well-done food when we were first courting each other, well, I was courting her, and she would order everything well done. I assumed it was one of those kinds of little ironic jokes that people make in the first stages of courtship. And I didn't accept that it was an actual, real, moral taste that had been inculcated in her by her family until I actually went over for a cookout in her family's garden. And her father put a hamburger on the grill in the great Canadian way and left it there for minutes and then for another 10 minutes and then hours and days went by before her family thought this thing was ready to eat. And we carried this difference on through life with us. And something that starts off as a small mouth taste soon becomes a kind of wedge, and it drives you farther and farther apart until you sort of are sharing those kinds of unpleasant ray-like glares at each other when you go out to eat and you order something, whatever it is, and she says, "I'll have it well done." And you just give her that look. You can say it in French, too. It doesn't matter. Always unpleasant. And I guess what made it so complex, and this is another way that our mouth tastes and our moral tastes are constantly in communion, constantly in play, constantly one changing the other, is that I realized or became convinced after a certain amount of time that what this really was about was sex. Because nothing could be clearer than if you're a cook. I'm the cook of our house. I learned how to cook from my mother. And Martha, my wife, doesn't cook at all. Her mother was one of the feminists of that slightly older generation who tried to discourage their daughters from doing any kind of cooking because it was too anti-feminist. It was too much like housework. My mother was from a slightly later generation than her mother's, where there was a kind of odd feminist deviation where mastering the art of cooking was a sign of feminine empowerment rather than a sign of feminine enslavement. Martha doesn't cook at all, so I do all the cooking in the family, somewhat still in our society, in our culture, somewhat feminine role. But she does all the driving. I don't know how to drive at all. I'd be lost if I lived here in California. I truly cannot. I've never been behind the wheel of a car for complicated reasons. And so I've always felt just a little bit uncomfortable with the reality that I am the one who sits in the right-hand seat in the car while she's driving. I'm the one who's working the radio and the CD player and telling the children, just shh. Please don't interrupt while your mother's trying to drive. I play that role, and I'm the one who cooks. And yet, therefore, this rejection of rareness I took inevitably as a rejection of my gestures at masculinity. It got really kind of nasty, finally, because I discovered that she was trying to convert our children to well-done-ism over time. We have two kids who I've written about, Luke and Olivia, and I found that they were actually using this word well done again and again in restaurants and when we'd go out to eat in simple places. And finally, one day I was cooking at home and I made a plate of tuna. One of my favorite meals to make, I think I even discuss it in this book, is tuna au poivre. You know, when you make fresh tuna in the manner of steak au poivre, we have lots of five kinds of peppers and oil laid on top of it, then you sauté it quickly, and then you make a sauce with brandy and creme fraiche. It's a wonderful dish. I recommend it highly if you haven't tried it. A great way to have tuna. And, of course, the only way to have it is to serve the tuna rare, which is indeed what I did. And I put it down in front of my family with lovely basmati rice, and they all did that terrible thing that your children do of kind of skillfully pushing the food around on their plate rather than actually addressing it. And at that point, I became a terrible person. I got up. I was so hurt, so upset, and so offended, and felt so rejected in all of my roles, erotic and domestic alike, that I got up and did something I had never done in 25 years of marriage. I stomped out of the room. And Martha came after me, and she said, with a vehemence that I'd never heard in this very, very gentle, beautiful Scandinavian girl in these 25 years. She said, "You are going back in the kitchen and you are finishing cooking that fish." And I turned around, and I did. And I did. There was no choice. I had to do it. And I realized at that moment that this was one of those wedges in a marriage, this fight about mouth taste and moral taste rooted in this business of how well done or raw your food was going to be, that we simply couldn't sustain for another 25 years. We couldn't be like my aunt and my uncle arguing this thing right to the edge of the grave. We'd become too miserable with each other. So I made a simple transformation in my cooking at that point. I started to braise everything. Because when you braise things, as you know, if you're a cook at all, the only issue becomes not rare or well done, but tough or tender. And tenderness becomes the goal of your marriage in the second 25 years. Not rawness and rareness representing raw sexuality, but tenderness in every regard representing the continuity of life. And Martha, to her enormous credit, intuitively discovered the matching word to match my new technique. And that word, blessed word that it is medium. Because the great thing about saying medium, the great thing about ordering something medium is that it's always a prefix, really. Medium isn't really a descriptive word, it's a prefix. Because what you say is, I'll take it medium, well done. Or, I'll take it medium, rare. So you can both actually be looking each other in the eye and be in agreement and simultaneously be switching it off for the benefit of the waiter. Long-term marriages, I have come to the conclusion, are all braised medium. Beyond that, the truth is that the great thing, if you are in a long-term marriage where you eat together every night of your life, except on those rare occasions when I'm away, when either I cook or we go out together, what you really do discover through the kinds of compromises of moral tastes that you make over time, what you really do discover is that the great thing about a long-term marriage is that the price goes down and the portions always get bigger. That's the kind of story and anecdote about the way food changes our lives, shapes our lives, frames our lives, how the rituals of eating change who we are, which I try to tell in historical contexts, in personal contexts, in a reportorial context by going to different places, in this book, The Table Comes First. It's really a study in the relationship between mouth taste and moral taste over a long period of time, from around 1780, when the restaurant is invented for the first time in France, right up till the present day. It studies that relationship in time. It studies it in space. I went off to France, went back to France to profile the great chef Alain Passard, a man who made what is, in the terms of high French cooking, a revolutionary turn from being a cook who did the whole range of meats to being the first 3-star vegetarian chef in France. I went to Barcelona and to the north of Spain to study in situ the great molecular cooks, Ferran Adrià and the Roca brothers, and that whole range of new high-tech cooking. And I got caught on the path, the pilgrimage to hot ice cream. And to blindfold tasting, I actually went to the great research center in Barcelona, the great dessert research center, the Epé de Sucre, where all of the classes are taught with the students blindfolded, so they'll never be misled by their eyes into betraying their tastes. Head of the school told me this, we were speaking French to each other, and I was sure I was misunderstanding him, and I kept saying, "Vous? You mean that? Really blindfolded?" And indeed he does. Everybody who enters the school gets a silk blindfold on the day they come in, and they do all their work blindfolded. So I went in space, went in time studying this thing, went in space to Barcelona. And most of all, perhaps, I went deep into my own experience to try and write about why it is that in our lives, particularly at this moment in time, food has become not just a diversion, not just a necessity, but the material of our medicinal preoccupations, the material of our macho adventures on television particularly, and sometimes it almost seems the material of our messianic expectations of what the bounty of nature and abundance can do for our moral existence. Mouth taste and moral taste is its fundamental formula and the back and forth between the two. And I would love to talk about it, if we can. The subject's chair.
The subject's chair. Right. Well, thank you very much, Adam. My name is Stephen Salm. I'm the editor of Santa Clara Magazine, and I will be moderating your questions tonight. So if you have the question cards, please fill those out and pass those to the folks in the aisles who are collecting them. I have a few to kick things off here, but Adam is here to talk to you and to tell stories tonight. So thanks very much for getting us started. One of my favorite moments in the book, one of my favorite phrases used is, life is green curry.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you mean? Life is green curry. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I like green curry. So I think, you know, Thai green curry, it's a wonderful thing. Everybody here knows what Thai green curry is, right? Where you'd have it's, you know, that basic wonderful Thai mix of basil and cilantro and mint chopped together, and you make a wonderful spicy paste. The thing about green curry is I learned to cook green curry when we were living in France, and I had never tasted green curry. For some reason, my gustatory path and a Thai restaurant had never intersected. And I liked the sound of it when I was reading it. And so I decided I got a recipe book. And one of the things that's funny about actually living in Europe, and I think this would be true in Italy, it certainly was true in France, is that you begin, if you were raised in North America, you begin to get a certain kind of desperate hunger for certain kinds of spicy and vibrant tastes, the taste of cilantro, the buzz of hot Thai bird peppers. When you're on a regular diet of the green herbs of France, thyme and tarragon and the young proteins of France, pork and lamb, you have this hunger for those things. So I had this recipe for green curry, and I made it, and it came out way too soupy. It came out almost like a soup, and I thought, this is wrong. This must be something wrong. So I spent a great deal of time trying to thicken the curry without betraying it, without making it glutinous or unappealing. And I spent a lot of time in my Parisian kitchen working on getting the green curry right until we came home. I was following the recipe, trying to figure out what the recipe was missing, where I had gotten wrong. Well, I came home to New York, and we were living on 88th Street, about two steps down, one street over from a great Thai restaurant, Sala Thai, and went in and ordered it, and it was exactly as soupy as the way I had made it from the recipe. And I realized at that moment that this is the way life is, right? We're constantly engaged in trying to translate instructions into reality. And in fact, I preferred my green curry, the thicker green curry, the more kind of coconut custardy green curry, to the one they'd made. So we're constantly engaged in trying to follow directions, follow instructions. And yet in the course of improvising from those instructions into a dish, we're constantly changing things. And very often, the unexpected result of the instructions, of following the instructions, is better than not. I mentioned it in the book because, and this will seem, when you first follow this path, you will say, that seems completely, has nothing to do with the subject. But then eventually it will come right back around and it will seem to have something to do with the subject. There's a great British political philosopher named Michael Oakeshott, was one. And Oakeshott's favorite, he was conservative, a very conservative political philosopher. And his favorite metaphor for politics was the recipe book, in the sense that that's what he said politics is not. He was arguing with sort of liberal utopians who said, here's the way society should be, and if we only follow these instructions, if we follow the recipe or the blueprint for a better world, we would make a better world. And Oakeshott said, that's not the case, because he said, cooking isn't like that. In other words, following a recipe isn't how you become a good cook. You become a good cook by mastering the craft of cooking, which is intangible and is much more like a knack, an artisanal ability. And he said, that's the way real politicians, good politicians, are like that. They don't have fixed principles that they follow. They have pragmatic intuitions that they realize. So he was against the recipe book line of reasoning about cooking. But what's interesting about it is that you realize that there is no recipe book in a sense to begin with, that Oakeshott is wrong about cooking, because cooking isn't something where you just have an artisanal knack, and it isn't something where you just follow directions. What it is this kind of constant intersection between the directions that you're given and the knack that you've achieved. So in that way, life is like green curry, that you're constantly, and politics are like green curry. Politics aren't simply following a set of fixed principles which will show you everything, but they're not either just a set of pragmatic intuitions that you make up as you go along. Instead, politics are like green curry. You have a recipe, you have a result, you change the result in light of the recipe, you change the recipe in light of the result. And it's that constant back and forth between the rules that we make up and the results that we have that is the nature of life.
Now, you mentioned your mother already, and in addition to one of her claims to fame being teaching you how to cook, she's
one of her least important.
She's a preeminent linguist, mm-hmm. and one of the ways that you talk about cooking in this book is talking about the grammar and the accent and understanding those together, yeah. and how that comes together in terms of cookbooks as well. Wondering if you could talk about that, because that linguistic component.
Sure. My mom is she's retired now. She and my father retired to a farm in northern Ontario, which struck their kids as an insane move on their part, but they've been happy there now for 10 years. She studied the genetic basis of grammars and many other things. In any case, one of the things that's interesting about cooking, and it's exactly like it's very much like the whole question of the recipe book and the green curry, is that you have certain kind of rules that you basically follow. And over time, you learn those rules, not just the rules of the cookbook, you know, not just, you know, a quarter cup of flour and eight egg yolks and so on. But sort of basic principles that when you're sautéing almost any piece of protein, you do it 4 minutes on one side and 3 minutes on the other side. It's very rare that it doesn't come out well, unless you're married to a woman who likes well-done things. But as I've explained to you, that will work itself out over a quarter century of experience. You have those things. And then you have accents that you put in them. There's a very good book called, it's not called How to Cook, that's Mark Bittman's book. It's called Cooking Without Recipes, I think. And it basically says that there's a certain number of steps. Then you deglaze the pan with some kind of liquid. Then you add some kind of thickener. And then you add some kind of herb. And you have cooked in the French manner. Yeah, and you add a little wine, then it's really in the French manner. So there are all of these kinds of basic steps, grammar in that sense, that you follow. But you're constantly adding accents. You say, I'm going to add the Szechuan pepper tonight instead of the black pepper. I'm going to make it with green peppercorns instead of white peppercorns. So you're constantly engaged in making accents. So that's, you know, so in that sense, cooking is very much like writing in that way, because you follow a grammar, but you always add an idiosyncratic accent. So I think that's what I was back. And at the end of this book, I have sort of tongue-in-cheek and a little bit ironically, but also sort of my basic rules of cooking. One of the things I learned, I used to hang around in, still do when I can, in pro-cook kitchens. You know, we're great in great restaurants and so on, because I love to sort of be in those kitchens and watch and chop onions occasionally and all of those things. And one of the other things you learn is that professional cooks, great cooks, salt and season much more liberally, much more aggressively than home cooks typically do. There's a lot more salt used in a French kitchen than you would imagine. The other thing they do is they use incredibly high heat. My friend Dan Barber, who's a wonderful chef in New York City, runs, I think, the best restaurant in New York, Blue Hill, and a farm that supplies at Stone Barns, once said to me that 375 is death. 375 is death. In other words, anything you roast or do at 375 degrees comes out terribly. You either go up to 500 or 450 if you're having, or you go all the way down to 200. But only fools roast in the middle range. And I thought, that's a nice principle. And if you follow it, you'll be amazed at how professional your food will suddenly start to become. So that's the kind of the grammar of cooking that you learn over time, and then you learn to accent it in your own way. I talk in the book about how my favorite accents, if I'm going in the sort of salty direction, I love anchovies and bacon. Bacon has sort of become fashionable. There's a kind of whole cult of bacon now, but everything tastes better with that in it. But anchovies, nobody really celebrates sufficiently. The anchovy is sort of the unsung hero of the kitchen and of the cupboard. But anchovies are amazing things. They're these tiny little humble things, and they dissolve themselves into whatever you're making. But they add so much salt and umami to the thing that they're great. And then in the other extreme, then I have a whole chapter about cinnamon and saffron and what they do and why they got banished from Western cooking back in the 18th century and only kind of come back in by way of North Africa now. So that's the kind of play of grammar and accent that I think is very much part of what we do when we cook.
Well, talk a little bit more about cinnamon and saffron, because I think that's one of the fascinating historic arcs that you follow in the book, how some particular spices are what we think of as being, you know, typical European cooking now, right? But how some spices might be banished because they're too easy.
Right, yeah, exactly. You know, one of the things that happens if you look at old recipe books or accounts of old meals is that in the 16th century, in Montaigne's time, you had a much more of a crossover between sweet tastes and savory tastes than was acceptable afterwards. You had fruit and meat served together all the time, honey and meat. And spices like saffron and cinnamon, which had come down almost in some ways from Roman times, and certainly had been revived during the Crusades, were very much part of the grammar, if you like, of cooking in France, for instance. And then with the kind of revolution around the end of the 18th century, those spices began to get banished. Carême, who's one of the great makers of French cooking, and was actually the hero of the first thing I ever wrote, which was it's funny how wherever I go, I seem to bring swing music with me. It's part of my, it's part of the kind, some kind of old 30s vibe that I carry in the center of my existence. And love it. That's a whole other,
that's
a whole other question about, so those spices got banished. Carême, it was this great codifier of cooking in the end of the 18th century, basically said those spices belong with sugar. They belong with sweet things. And also they're sort of obvious. They interfere with the pure tastes of the food we want to make. And he began using almost entirely green herbs, as I was describing, more tarragon and thyme, all of the rosemary, all those things that we associate with French cooking. And so those spices got removed. And at the same time, and this is, I'm embroider this because it's so much about how much history, anything you eat has a history to it, and the history is always interesting. Sugar got cheap. That's one of the great revolutions in modern, in the sense of, you know, since 1800, or since 1700 cooking. Sugar, for tragic reasons, because of the sugar plantations in the Caribbean particularly, sugar went from being a very rare spice that you used to flavor things the way we use saffron now, something very hard, just being something that was very abundant, and therefore you could build a whole dessert cuisine around it. So all the sugar in the menu, there's a wonderful food historian, Flandron, I think, who talks about this at length. If you look at menus in the beginning of the 17th century, the sugar, the sweetness, is distributed evenly throughout the meal. And by the end, all the sugar, it's like the table's been turned on edge like this, and all the sugar has slid down into dessert. And so each of the courses began to get much more codified and so on. And really, if you think about it, it's only in our own time that you've begun to sort of see it going back the other direction, partly under the influence of North African cooking, which kept intact a lot of those very old medieval traditions of having fruit and meat, saffron and cinnamon together with hot spices, for instance, make wonderful things, tagines. And sometimes when I'm in Paris, which I don't get to do as often as I want, but when I'm there, I'm just desperate. My favorite thing to have is North African food. That's some of the best food that you can find in France right now for that reason. So that's one of the ways, I think, in which cinnamon and saffron have played these very different roles at different moments in the history of cooking and in the history of our cooking.
Well, so let's jump from sort of history into the bleeding edge of cooking. And one of the folks in the audience wants to hear a little bit more. What is molecular cooking? Explain what that
molecular,
is.
Molecular cuisine. It's a name that's associated with the cooking of particularly Ferran Adrià, who ran a restaurant called El Bulli in Catalonia until it closed just last year, and now runs it as a research foundation that also serves meals. And I will confess that it has some of the quality of a Zen koan. I have not yet fully understood the difference between a restaurant that was open and serving customers and a food research foundation that serves the result of its researches. This seems to be as much a difference in nomenclature or conceivably in tax law as in the actual results. Nonetheless, Ferran Adrià and his brother Albert inherited or took over this, at the time, very conventional restaurant called El Bulli in Roses, outside of Barcelona. And they developed a relationship with a chemist at the university nearby, and they began using all kinds of devices that had been up to that point largely reserved for industrial food, for kind of supermarket food, freeze drying, for instance, turning things into gels and foams and smokes. And then they began to try and apply creatively, and that was the word they loved, creatively. So they began to invent an entirely new range, entirely new grammar of cooking that depended on those kinds of transformations, that you could turn a sea urchin not just into a boiled or a poached sea urchin, you could turn it into a powdered sea urchin, and you would have the pure flavor of sea urchin in the form of flakes. You could do the same thing to almost anything. You could take olive oil, and I forget the name of the machine they used to do this to, but you could make a kind of ersatz olive that would be made entirely of olive oil. It looks like an olive, but it explodes in your mouth when you bite into it. And they followed this line in down amazing and strange paths. They began to do what they called deconstructed cuisine, where they would take all the elements of a famous dish and break them apart and then not reassemble them. But then they would change the quality of each thing. Strange juxtapositions of taste. Goat brain tartare with scampi and ginger, that kind of thing. And it was called molecular cuisine because they were dealing with food for the first time, really, at the molecular level, the transformations were molecular. But they dislike, Ferran Andrea hates the name molecular cuisine, and what he likes it to be called is techno-emotional cooking. Techno-emotional cooking. Because as he said to me, rather winningly once, that's a much simpler name for it. And it occurred to me silently that any cuisine in which the simpler name is techno-emotional can fairly be called not simple. And that's what they are doing. And they became the temple and the magnet for cooks from around the world. And pretty much generations, Thomas Keller, for instance, of ambitious young cooks passed through their kitchen. There's a very good book by a writer named Lisa Abend called The Sorcerer's Apprentices, just about the life of these young Oompa Loompas who went to El Bulli and were bullied for months at a time and then transformed cooking. And it's one of the big questions. Actually, it's funny talking about the line between sweet and savory. We were talking about a moment ago, cinnamon, saffron being banished, then brought back in. I went to El Bulli because I wanted to write something about desserts as the last chapter in this book. It's not quite the last chapter, but sort of the last adventure in this book, because the book is sort of organized like a meal and begins with the act of entering a restaurant and ends with, what else, dessert. And I said to Audria very seriously, if not solemnly, if not pompously, I said, do you think that we have violated finally the line, broken the line, transgressed the line between the sweet and the savory? And he looked at me with this look of delighted triumph, and he said, I cannot believe an American is asking me that question. What is your national meal? He said, it is the hamburger with ketchup, French fries, and a Coca-Cola. He said, every day Americans violate the line between sweet and savory. And they do it that way. Which was very clear. Yeah, so, and I slunk away, feeling appropriately abashed at that answer. So that's what molecular cuisine is. And one of the big questions is it a new path for food, for cooking, or is it essentially a show? Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who are in the sort of slow food movement, who are in the local, who are concerned with local cooking, who are concerned with the natural and the organic, who are appropriately skeptical about whether or not molecular cuisine is essentially a tourist trap, in plain English, or if it's a new direction for food. And that's one of the big questions that I try and tug away at in this book.
Well, and one of the points that you make in the book also is that in some sense there's a move toward eating more like peasants in the old days.
Yes.
Explain that.
Well, I say at some point in the book, you know, if you ask yourself, if you go up to northern Massachusetts, and you see, you know, one person is eating whole wheat bread, home-baked bread, local cheese, storage apples, and heritage bacon. Is he likely to be a farmer or a professor of comparative literature at the liberal arts college? I think he's likelier to be a professor of comparative literature at the liberal arts college than the farmer with whom that kind of diet would have been associated 100 years ago. So, just what I was talking about in my little preamble there, mouth taste and moral taste. That particular set of mouth tastes have become a whole moral taste, and we define ourselves very much. We express our beliefs by choosing to eat those kinds of things. You know, in America especially, it's not so much that you are what you eat, but you eat what you are. And it's very unusual, I don't know if you find this to be true, to go to dinner at someone's house and not know their politics within minutes of tasting their hors d'oeuvres. You know instantly where they stand and who they vote for just by seeing what the first thing is that they bring out and serve to you. And that's the way mouth taste becomes moral taste. Our spices become symbols and so on.
So from mouth taste and moral taste to Montreal taste, here's a question. What is a Montreal bagel?
This morning I was on Michael Krasny's wonderful program talking, blabbing away for an hour. And Michael was on the subject of what is Canadian cuisine. I'm Canadian by upbringing, and I also just came back from doing a lecture series in Canada, the Massey Lectures. And he put me on the spot, what is Canadian cuisine? And I sort of did one of those Jackie Gleason, Chef of the Future moments. I'm dub, 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 I couldn't think. And then I thought of the Montreal bagel. If anyone here has ever spent time in Montreal will know that after the Second World War, there was a huge exodus of Jewish Holocaust survivors, in plain English, who came to Montreal. And some of them, I think from Romania, started a bagel bakery on a street called Saint-Viateur in Montreal. And it's actually one of my memories from as a child, as we used to go and get these bagels, and you could see the tattooed number on the arm of the guy who was putting the bagels into this wonderful wood-burning oven. And they were bagels not made like these kind of puffy, soft pretzels with tiny holes that you get, I'm afraid to say, in my adopted city of New York, but bagels that were sweet, boiled first and then baked in this super hot wood-burning oven. And they were incomparably better. I am on permanent strike. I will not eat a New York bagel or an American bagel. It has to be a Montreal bagel. And that's what a Montreal... Thank you, someone there from Canada. And that's what a Montreal bagel is. Michael ruled it out as not really being Canadian, but being Jewish. But it's in the nature of Canada to be, aside from Inuit food, blubber and so on, that's who Canadians are. We're all emigres from someplace else who then come south again and then go back up north and so on. That's a Montreal bagel, and they are incomparably better. Why no one has started Montreal bagel bakeries elsewhere? One reason is because the dammed up wood-burning ovens are extremely dangerous, and they had to actually pass a bylaw in Montreal grandfathering in the wood-burning ovens at Saint-Viateur and the Fairmount Bagel Bakery, these two great rival bagel bakeries, to allow them to go on.
Well, you mentioned World War II and that it was emigres who came to open the bakery. One of the really poignant moments in the book, actually, that you opened with, is telling a story of a last meal. And I'm wondering if you could share that with the audience, because I think it's...
I was reading, actually, one of my heroes as a writer in about everything, but including and especially food, is the great A.J. Liebling, Abbot Joseph Liebling, who was a New Yorker writer from the mid-30s till the late 50s. Ate himself to death, but that's a whole other story. And he had assembled a collection of resistance writing in 1949 that was published and then forgotten. I found it in a secondhand bookstore. And in it, he reproduced a letter written by a man named Jacques Decaux, which wasn't actually his real name. That was his resistance name. His real name was Daniel Decaux de Manche. He was a German instructor, actually, at a very good French lycée. And he was a resistant, very, very brave man, a communist, actually. And he was arrested by the Germans and sentenced to death. The Germans were going to execute him. And the morning of his execution, he wrote a last letter to his parents. And in this letter, he doesn't talk about the principles of Marxism for which he's giving his life. He doesn't talk about his love of France for which he's going to give his life. He doesn't even write about his love of his mistress, his girlfriend, who he will never see again, or his parents. He writes about the meals he's had. And he writes to his parents, I want you to think about the meal we shared with Simone. I want you to get the menu from the Auberge de Quatre Pavés d'Oie and make sure you give it to my lover. Make sure you give it to my girlfriend. I make sure that you think about the meal that we all celebrated on New Year's Eve with other friends. He lists all these wonderful meals they had together. And he concludes, he says, beautiful understatement. He says, as you can see, questions of food have taken on great importance. And And as soon as I read that, I said, that's the subject I want to explore in this book. What did Jacques Decour mean by questions of food have taken on great importance? He obviously didn't mean, let's try the next fashionable place next week. That was not an option for him. He didn't even mean, what food can we eat that will extend our lives most? That was not an option for him. He didn't mean even, you know, what's the sustainable agriculture for France, significant though that subject is. He meant something else. What did he mean by questions of food? And that's the subject that the book really goes to take on. And at the very end of the book, I got curious. There are lots of continuities in France, more than in the States. And I thought to myself, maybe what was this restaurant, the Cap Pavé de Bois, for paving stones of the king? And I went online and looked it up, and goddammit, it was still there. It was still in existence about an hour outside of Paris in a little town near Versailles. So I went with my wife and my two kids. We went out, and we had lunch at Jacques Decour's restaurant in tribute to him. And that's how the book ends. We went back to this restaurant that was on his mind, whose menu was the last gift he left for his lover. And I don't think that's a question. I mean, I spend, you know, the 400 pages of the book trying to answer the question, what did he mean by questions of food at the end of his life? But obviously what he meant was something about the continuities of communal existence, something about the way that the moments that are the most precious, the most important, the most intimate, the most tender in every way that we share tend to gather around a table at home, a table in a restaurant, a table at an inn, and that by pledging his life to those values, he was saying something offhand seeming, but very profound, that he was a secular man. He was not looking to heaven. He didn't expect to be reborn. But in the continuities of the table through his life and the persistence of the table after his death, there was a vein of real Epicurean, in the deepest sense, of human materialism that meant a great deal to him. I had one of the epigraphs of the book is from Charles Darwin, a hero of mine, as well as he is of us all, I suppose, and where Darwin said once, very shrewdly, he said, "We have happy days, remember good dinners." And what he meant by that, of course, is that when we have a happy day, it tends to focus in our memory into the good dinner that we enjoyed. So that was Jacques Decour, and he supplied me the kind of basic text that set me off on this quest.
Well, and naturally, there are folks here who wonder, so what would Adam Gopnik's last meal be if you could choose it? And you talk about that.
Yeah, I do. You know, the truth is that I'm an anxious person, and I think I would be far too anxious at that moment to eat with any kind of pleasure, honestly. I talk about my perfect meal in the course of the book, and I do have a kind of perfect meal in the back of my mind. It's not a very honorable meal in lots of ways. I like great sort of cuisine bourgeois, French cuisine bourgeois, so I would love to have a great roast chicken or a Côte de Veau foyot, and certainly my mother's Grand Marnier soufflé at the end of it, and that would be all right. You know, the one thing that strikes me, one of the things that I talk about a lot in the book is that whatever the last meal is that we might choose to have, the world really enjoys one common meal. That's a very strange thing if you think about it at all. The truth is that of the 7 billion people on the planet tonight, some enormous proportion of those people will dine tonight on a neutral starch and a pungent protein. They'll eat pasta with spaghetti with bolognese sauce, or they'll eat rice and curry, or they'll eat spiced ants with cassava root. But that's basically the one human meal. We have a neutral starch, and we put a pungent protein on it, chili, whatever. And that's what we eat, green curry. Green curry, that's why life is like green curry. And I'm always struck by that thought, that if you were a Martian looking at the planet, writing back your report on the planet Earth, you'd say, they all eat all the time. They all eat exactly the same thing. And it would look like exactly the same thing, neutral starch and pungent protein. And yet we know the incredible, vibrant variety that we have within it. And it's being conscious of both things at once, I think, the universality of eating and the specificity of eating, that makes us appreciate it, understand it.
One of the audience members here comments that they have a friend in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia who says he would never eat dinner alone. Wondering if you can talk about that, because you talk a lot about the communal table.
Yes, and that's an important thing. You know, I think that, and I hesitate to be evangelical about this because we all live divided lives and difficult lives, and it's not easy to put four people, much less eight people, around a table night after night. But I nonetheless think that the table is the raft that gets us down the river of life, and that the single thing that's sort of there's no question, this is not just a prejudice, but a scientific result, that having dinner every night together is probably the best thing you do for your kids' education, the best thing. It's much better than buying them Baby Einstein or any of that nonsense. Sitting with them every night, night after night after night, sharing a meal, talking about everything that's happened through the day and that will happen again, is the most salubrious thing you can do for family life. But having saying that, I also love to eat alone. That's a great pleasure of mine. I'm on the road a great deal of the time, unfortunately. We call it the perpetual tuition tour in our household. And I find myself very often in wonderful places, in San Francisco or Portland tomorrow night or wherever I am, alone at the end of an evening like this. My interlocutor goes off to his family table and says goodnight to me, and there I am, a lonely man on the street. And one of the pleasures of modern existence is that you can find a diner or a coffee shop or a restaurant that's open late, and you go in with your Sports Illustrated, and you sit down and you order. And there's something quite magical about being anonymous in a public place. I think that's a key pleasure of being a modern person, is that you can go into such a place, get a perfectly warm greeting. They have to give you a warm greeting. You're paying for the warm greeting. You're in a room with many other people. You're intimate with them in that sense. You're not removed from them. And yet you're alone, and yet you have an anonymity. I love that emotion, and you'll often see me as the man sitting by the wall with his Sports Illustrated magazine there, taking pleasure in the environment.
Well, and in the book, you even write about looking at the Edward Hopper's painting, Nighthawks at the Diner, right? And you know,
I can't get that painting. Everyone always talks about this study of alienation and misery. This poster of the heartlessness and the anime of her, they look like they're having a very good time to me. I never understood that. What are they eating? I would love to be at that counter having that meal. And if you know where it is, it's actually on Greenwich Avenue, where the place was that Hopper was painting, on Greenwich Avenue in New York City. That's a wonderful street. I think that's a great place to be. I've never understood why people, I would love, you know, it's midnight, the cop is there, right? The streetwalker. It's a very cozy kind of little scene. And I would love to go up to that counter and order a bowl of chili and have my New York Post and turn the pages. I'd be completely happy. I don't get it. You're not supposed to read the picture that way, I know, but I do.
So here, someone wants to follow up on your comment about how if you go to dinner at someone's place, you'll know from the appetizers, you know, what their politics are. So what is a conservative dinner? What's a liberal dinner? What are you going to get?
A liberal dinner, you'll get raw, locally grown vegetables, right? We've just been to the farmer's market. We went to the farmer's market this afternoon, and they had these amazing purple carrots. You know, Mr. Mangieli, you know the whole family, don't you? Well, we've gotten to be very close to them, and they always save the purple carrots for us. Just have them with a little bit of water and some salt. Oh, and this is fleur de sel. Have them just with a touch of fleur de sel. You're in, that's not even Obama voters. That's the extreme left that you're dining with that night. One of the things that tends to happen is that conservatives, because they feel under the oppressive weight of that kind of food piety, they go in the extreme opposite direction. If you get kind of retro food, you get a Ritz cracker with pimentos and cream cheese. It's either an extremely sophisticated gay couple or it's a right-wing family that you're dining with, one or the other. It's either people who have such sophisticated taste that they've sort of lapped the track and come around all around the other way, or you're in a right-wing, you're amongst... the exception to that is then you're with Romney supporters. If you're in the South and you're given really good food, great barbecue or something, unfortunately, you're probably in amongst Perry supporters, whether you want to be or not. That's the place where unfortunately, the best food bends right the farther south you go in the country. And the people who are on your side of the fence tend to try and reproduce the food that you left behind. So that's the one exception I would make to that rule. But you can read the clues there as well.
Well, and you actually also trace this path when you talk about food writing in the book, what the politics of many food writers have been and where that happens to be. I wonder if you can talk about that, especially in France.
Yeah, it's especially true in France. It's especially true in France. One of the oddities, you know, food writing, good food writing and an obsession with food in the United States has always sort of turned towards the liberal end of things, not exclusively and not always, but on the whole, it works that way. That is, if you show yourself concerned about food, you're concerned about sustainable agriculture in part. But you also have a tropism towards Europe. You like France and like Italy. You don't regard those as decadent, scary socialist places and so on. So that has always tended to govern the way things go here. In France, beginning in the post-revolutionary period, I talk about this very important food writer named Grimaud. And one of the things that happened is that food in the culinary traditions of France became identified with French nationalism. That is one of the things that if you cared passionately about French cooking and French food, it meant that you were a French nationalist of a kind. You thought France had indigenous traditions that were exceptional. It was French exceptionalism. French exceptionalism. Everyone talks about American exceptionalism. Well, French exceptionalism is just as aggressive, and it was based on food. We eat better and cook better than anyone else in the world, and we shouldn't allow outsiders to corrupt or adulterate our food. That's a kind of right-wing turn of mind. And French food writing always, wonderful writing in many cases, always tended to turn in that direction for a very long time. The most influential food writer of the mid-20th century in France was a man named Robert Courtine, who wrote for Le Monde. He was the food critic at Le Monde. And it was only after his death, and I wrote something about this when we were living there because this all came out then, only after his death did it come out that he had been a violent anti-Semite during the 1940s and a collaborator, but not just a sort of passive collaborator, but a very active one. And tragically, unfortunately, but that was the way a lot of French food writing bent. In fact, I have a chapter in the book about this new French food movement called Le Fooding, which is deliberately perverse in using an English word, fooding, not even an English word, a made-up word, to write about. And one of the things they're trying to do is not so much turn food writing towards the left, but turn it in a kind of more libertarian direction. Say, great food comes from all over. We don't have to be hostage to a French tradition alone to be French, to love, to be French and love food. You don't have to be a French nationalist.
So it's an answer to the whole Michelin rating system.
Well, Le Fooding, yes. Le Fooding is particularly in, they have their own guide now, which is a sort of like the old impressionists, you know, sort of salon de refusé against the Michelin guide, which they believe has had a stranglehold on French cooking for too long.
So a number of folks have asked, you know, your favorite places to go for chocolate or your favorite desserts. I'll let you handle it. What you reveal something about dessert in this book.
I talk about dessert at length, but do you mean my favorite places in Paris or my favorite places in the world?
You talk about refusing dessert, moving beyond dessert
that
yourself.
That was here in San Francisco. That's right. About 3 years ago, I was doing something at City Arts and Letters. I know we're not in San Francisco now, but in the Bay Area. That I was doing something, and I, for the first time in my life, I didn't have dessert. My mom is this great dessert cook. As I was saying before, she forces desserts on my father night after night after night after night of their married life. And I had always just had one. And you reach a certain point as you cross 45 when you realize that they're not just going away anymore, that they're not just vanishing the way they'd always vanished, that you actually have these kinds of, you become stout.
I think, yeah, doughier, I think, is what
yes, exactly.
you use.
Doughy. You become doughy. I didn't want to be doughy. So I stopped eating desserts. And I discovered, I have friends, you know, who have been through rehab and all of that, gifted people. And you know how it is, you never quite internalize what that's like, you know, your friend who's been a cocaine addict or an alcoholic. And you can't sort of put your mind, why would someone as gifted as you are, as intelligent, as able as you are, why would you even mess around with stuff like that? Until you give up desserts when you're somebody who loves sugar. And you find yourself sort of being guided automatically towards the freezer and the ice cream, and you can't keep away. And you realize that the attraction, addiction isn't an active state. That's the whole tragedy of addiction. Addiction is a passive state. And in order to surrender to it, you just have to stop trying to fight it. It will take you over very, very happily. And that is the, I realize now, I mean, being a sugar addict is a minor version of this. That's the nature of addiction. It's a passive wave that just takes you over. And if you read about addicts' memoirs, that's what they talk about, right? It's not that I made a decision to go back on the booze or go back on the pipe. It was just I stopped fighting it for one day, and that's what happened. So anyway, that I stopped eating desserts for a year, and that made me acutely, painfully self-conscious about this thing that had always just been part of my life, and that's what led me to write about them.
But you've come back to dessert.
Yes, I have come back to desserts. I now I joined a better gym, and once you join a better gym, then you can justify sweets to yourself better.
So maybe you could answer, right, if you have any favorite places in the Bay Area, for chocolate places.
Oh, gosh, I wish I had something that specialized. I love, now I'm going to lose my mind. I think that the chocolate, the artisanal chocolate made here that begins with an R, ricotta, is that what I mean? Yes, is the best chocolate in America. I always love it. It's very hard to find in New York, and I always have it here. And I try and bring it back to New York, but it always melts in my luggage. Always. So I can't do it. So I love that chocolate. I think that's fabulous chocolate.
You know, one of the dimensions to the book is the philosophical dimension in right. talking about food. I mean, there are a number of philosophers who show up there, you know, Habermas and Foucault. And you've also shared a story about Derrida. I'm wondering if you could share that tonight. Another story about your mother.
Most of my stories tend to turn towards my mother. I was saying to someone this morning that in lots of ways this book, you know, the object of this book is food. The subject of this book is my relationship with my mother. And how I sort of, in that weird way that happens in families, chromosomes cross in some strange way so that my son is very much his mother's son completely, just like her, even though he's an entirely masculine person. And I am very much my mother's son in that way, too, and it's about that. The thing about, in a broader sense, the thing about the philosophical stuff in the book is, you know, I was self-conscious doing it because I didn't want it to be a heavy meal. I wanted it to be light and fun from beginning to end. But, you know, the great thing about philosophy is the reason that there are philosophers, I mean, some of it is just because they fill up academic departments. But the good reason to having philosophers is philosophers look at the deep questions. Philosophers are the people who go places and ask why. They don't just ask what, and they don't just ask how or from where. They ask why. Why do we have this institution of the restaurant? So someone like Jürgen Habermas, great German philosopher, really looks at cafes and restaurants and asks, why? What's the function that they serve? We have these weird places where people congregate to drink caffeine. Why? And he answered, well, they were very important in making democratic civilization. Because his whole theory is that in order to have a democratic civilization, it doesn't matter so much about whether you have free and fair elections. Those things are important, but they're not crucial. What really matters is that you have little groups. You have people who are accustomed to working together with strangers in non-official ways. And for him, the café in France was the necessary sort of preliminary to democracy. And by the way, that's not just an abstract idea. This has been proven to be true. Whenever you study where democracy takes and where democracy doesn't take in newly liberated countries, it takes happily in places where people are accustomed to singing together, to dining together, to going out to cafes where they have volunteer fire departments and amateur opera groups. People have the habit of cooperation and association. Democracy does very well there. When they don't have those habits in societies, it's still very much based on clan organizations. Russia, democracy takes very, very poorly or not at all. So that's why this philosophical stuff in the book, but I genuinely believe that, because I thought about it a lot when I was writing it, and that there's none of it is gratuitous, that all of it, I hope, earns its place at the table by helping you answer the why questions about the way we eat. The story, though, about the specific anecdote is about the great French literary critic and philosopher Jacques Derrida, who was in Montreal, and the man who brought him was a now forgotten figure named Eugenio Donato, who was my first great mentor as an eater. He was a man who came from Egypt, from an Italian mother and an Arabic-speaking father, was raised in there and then went to France and studied French, taught most of his life in America, spoke five languages with absolute fluency. I don't mean well. I mean absolute fluency, and all of them with an accent, every one with a strong and heavy accent that marked him as a foreigner. So he was this great kind of Nabokovian figure who belonged everywhere and nowhere. But he loved food, and he taught me the joys of eating. And he brought Derrida to my family's table just so he could taste my mother's Grand Marnier souffle. And it's one of the key memories of my adolescence is this little Algerian Frenchman, Derrida, with a spoon about to eat my mother's dessert. And I think he survived the experience intact. You know, the funny thing is Derrida is famous for being incredibly difficult, which he is, and very obscure, which he is, philosopher and critic. But at the end of his life, he wrote these wonderful little books about hospitality and about what it means to welcome strangers. And it was a kind of totally different, Americans don't tend to know about, it was a totally different turn in his work and a very welcome one. Not obscure at all, but actually, so maybe he was converted by the experience of dining at our table and said, aha, it's those Jewish people who, in Montreal, they had the right idea. They just sit around and eat.
Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time.
Oh, no, really?
Yes, but so I want to make a leap from Derrida to Keith Richards, who shows up in the book as well, right? Talking about the music of food. So you talk about, you compare cooking to, if I'm remembering right, tuning a guitar to an open
rice pudding and open G tuning. Keith Richards is, I've talked about Derrida, Darwin, Jacques Decoeur, Jürgen Habermas. Keith Richards is my greatest hero. I could not survive without the Stones, and particularly without Keith Richards' guitar playing. It's been my passion and obsession for a very long time. And I felt a little bit guilty about when I was writing this book, and I was writing all these recipes. It was about being my mother, right? And here I was writing this book, and I was filling it with recipes and cooking tips and all that. Is this really like a very macho kind of activity for a writer to be engaged in? And I got Keith Richards' wonderful autobiography, Life, which is a terrifically entertaining book, I don't have to mention. And as I say, you know, Keith is always, for me, kind of the opposite, the person that a little Woody Allen person like myself would dream of being. And what does he do in this book? I mean, he talks about his addictions, he talks about his women, he talks about Mick Jagger a great deal. But what does he really do with real zing and excitement? He gives you his favorite recipes, his recipe for shepherd's pie and his recipe for bangers and mash. And it's the longest thing in the book. It's, let me tell you how to make shepherd's pie. Nobody in America knows how to make shepherd's pie. And he tells you how to make shepherd's pie. And says, bangers and mash, they make all wrong in Connecticut, where I have to live. Let me tell you how to make bangers and mash. I thought, if Keith Richards can offer recipes, I can offer recipes to people. And then he makes a very interesting point, really subtle point. He's talking in another part of the book about the way he plays guitar. And rock and roll people will know this. He plays a very peculiar kind of tuning. Instead of having it in concert tuning, which is the way you normally play guitar, he has it in an open G. So when you strum five strings, he plays five strings, it's a G chord. And then all you have to do is bar the chord up and down, and you get all the other chords. And then you do make these funny little minor seventh shapes, and all of the Stones music comes out of that, all of those great, great songs. And he says something very smart about it. He says, the thing that makes that open G so wonderful, apart from the fact that you can be stoned out of your mind and still just moving your finger up and down the thing, is that you have a lot of kind of drone sounds because you have the same notes repeating over and over. And he says that's what gives it its kind of this, he's described it beautifully, this kind of weird folk resonant sound because you have all these drones going on. And he says very intelligently that Vivaldi writes music the same way, only the drone is in the top tone. And it occurred to me as I was reading this that this is very much like making rice pudding. Because rice pudding is sort of the open G tuning of cooking, right? It's very simple in one level, right? Everybody likes it. And yet, what you can do, every civilization has a rice pudding that they use as a sacred food for funerals, weddings, rites of passage. Wherever you go in the world, people have a sweet rice pudding with saffron, with cinnamon, with all those good things. And I realized it also has a kind of drone quality, right? It has a folk quality that you can turn into other things. And I realized that exactly what he was describing was the way that something, this very primitive kind of tuning in one way, was actually more sophisticated. Whereas rice pudding is like that, and that's why I gave three recipes, three completely different open G recipes for rice pudding in the book. And I will add only that what I do, my son, I play a kind of jazz guitar, very classy but not very Keith-like. And my son, who's become a guitarist, has a Gibson SG. If you play guitar, you know what that is. It's a real rock and roll guitar, which Keith Richards has played in times. And during the day, when I'm writing and I get frustrated, I sneak into his room and I retune his guitar in open G. And I plug it in, turn the amp up high, and pretend I'm Keith Richards for an hour or so. And this is an incredibly serene and placid 17-year-old, my son. But the other day, I get a phone call on the road, say, "Dad, Dad, did you retune my guitar? Did you put it in open G?" And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "If you ever put my guitar in open G again, put it back in concert." Boom. Down like that. First time in 17 years we'd ever had a fight, and it was because I was trying to be Keith Richards and he's trying to be Jimi Hendrix.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you very much, Adam Gopnik.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Adam Gopnik, author of The Table Comes First, Family France and the Meaning of Food, Steve Salm, editor of Santa Clara Magazine, the Bernard Osher Foundation, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.